I'm Linda Pelagio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to the heritageradionetwork.org Week in Review, where me, Jack Inslee, executive producer, and the one and only Aaron Fairbanks, executive director, recap the week in Heritage Radio Network programming and beyond. What's up, Aaron?
Oh, man, it's wet and soggy this Friday morning. I'm not loving it.
Yeah, this theme song kind of felt like a snow day to me. I don't know. It's a snowy little tune. It's nasty out here. Not going to be quite as bad as it was a few weeks ago.
No, but it definitely, like, my walk to work today has got me thinking about lunch already. I'm like, what am I going to do to counteract the winter blues?
I made the brilliant decision to wear Vans today. I'm like, really?
Fail.
That was the footwear of choice today?
Fail. I have my Canadian boots, so I am fully snugged up here in the studio.
Way more appropriate. So, if, you know, you're listening to the show for the first time, you're about to find out that we opened this program by recapping our last great bite. And I'll kick it off. My last great bite wasn't great with a capital G, and that's my own fault, but it was a recipe from Melissa Clark, kind of like a caramelized lemon pasta, one of those like pantry clearing dishes, you know, where it's like all you need to make this is four lemons, olive oil, pasta, and, you know, Parmesan cheese. So you're kind of like, you blanch these lemon slices and then you're supposed to fry them and caramelize them, and then you're making a pasta sauce with a bunch of lemon zest and pasta water and cheese and butter. It was delicious. It was really, really delicious. And didn't, reading the recipe, I was kind of like, really? This will be good.
But like lemon pasta.
Oh, sorry. The red chili flakes. That's what makes it.
Yeah.
Cut through with a bunch of spice. Yeah. And I always double any chili flake spec in any recipe because, you know, people are scared of spice.
So you said this was a small, not a capital G grate. What happened?
I didn't caramelize the lemons enough, I don't think. I get scared of burning things sometimes. And I'm like, oh, those look like they've kind of browned. And the slices were just a bit too bitter. So I kind of like ended up eating around the lemon slices. The pasta was delicious, but, you know, next time I'm going to crisp it up. But yeah, Melissa Clark, cool recipe.
Awesome. Cool she was in the studio this week too.
She was indeed. That's what sparked it.
Tech Bites episode, a great episode. We're going to actually hear a little clip from later in the show. So hang tight. Well, my last great bite was, you know, capital G great. I had dinner earlier this week with Carrie Diamond, who hosts Radio Cherry Bomb here on the network. And as you do when you're dining with Carrie, we went to check out a lovely lady chef, an amazing woman in food, Leah Cohen, who runs the kitchen and is the co-owner over at Pig and Cow. Delicious, delicious meal. It was funny. We both sat down and realized that it was restaurant week in Manhattan, which somehow had escaped both of us. So feeling a little sheepish, we went for the kind of full-on restaurant week experience. It was four courses, I think $44. Everything was super delicious. Probably my faves were some of the starters. She did a roasted eggplant dip and a Brussels sprout and pig jowl dish that were delicious. But if I'm like really being honest, and I think maybe just because this weather's got me feeling kind of cozy and homey, the coconut rice was so delicious. And I guess I just have to say, like, folks, if you are in the New York City metro area, definitely check out Leah's restaurant. And in particular, might be fun to swing by next February 10th because they are doing a pop-up with Chow Bao Biscuit, which is one of Charleston's finest restaurant establishments. Super excited to have those folks up in the city. And I'm sure they're going to be cooking up a storm and the dinner is going to sell out. So get tickets if you have not already.
So you say the full restaurant week experience. Does that mean, like, I guess restaurants around New York City all have tasting menus?
Yeah, they put together like a pre-feed menu. You get a couple of choices. And so we just went for it. And of course, Leah was such a doll. She sent us out some extra things to taste. So I rolled out of there, which I, you know, honestly, I'm just going to recommend because everything was so delicious. It's definitely like go in, stuff yourself, order all the things. It was super fun.
That sounds great. All right. Well, let's transition into the studio and listen to some clips from the week. Our theme song came in heavy today. So, yeah, winter season is in full swing over here. We've got some ambitious goals, and the programming is a big part of that. And this week felt really good. A lot of really heavy guests in this. Not heavy guests. Heavy
winter hitting. Weight. We got a winter weight up.
Yeah. Heavy hitting. Let's say
figuratively.
That.
Figuratively, not literally.
Yeah. So let's start with something a little bit light here. This is Sam Sifton, who, if you are into food, you know all about Sam Sifton, the food editor for the New York Times, former food critic for the New York Times. And he is talking about I guess, Super Bowl dish, or a dish that you could make over the Super Bowl, kind of a slow-cooked thing. It's a Mississippi roast. And Aaron, I think you may know a thing or two about it. I'm not sure. But let's play the clip of Sam Sifton explaining his discovery of the Mississippi roast. This was on Sharp and Hot, hosted by Emily Peterson.
How did it come to your attention in the first place?
Well, we were talking at the office one day, and one of my colleagues, who's a graduate of Ole Miss, said something about cooking Mississippi roast over the weekend, and the name alone piqued my interest, and I said, Mississippi roast, what's that? And she described it, a pot roast put in a slow cooker with a stick of butter, some of that packaged au jus gravy mix that I didn't really know existed, another package of something I didn't know existed, which is dry ranch dressing mix, and a handful of pepperoncini. And for whatever reason, it piqued my interest, and I thought, huh. And so I made it, and it was pretty outstanding. However, as the food editor of the New York Times, and as a guy who doesn't really like those packaged ingredients very much, I wondered how hard it would be to make without using packaged ingredients. So I made it. And it was even more outstanding. And then I was like, where the hell did this come from? And I spent a long time reporting that out, and I tracked it down to a small town in northern...
Oh, man. So, you know, this is not... I mean, well, this would be a great Super Bowl recipe. Don't get me wrong. This was not, like, geared towards a Super Bowl event. This is the recipe that, like, frankly, broke the internet. People were going crazy for this. I have to say... I love on Sam's Instagram feed, he's like, they're calling me a redneck and they're calling me an elitist New York snob. So I think I'm doing something right.
Wow.
Yeah. And I love that in the original recipe, you know, it definitely calls for a package of Hidden Valley Ranch, the dry dressing mix, which I think to me is like what really makes this recipe so interesting. It's like, It's like right there with the kind of like trashy deliciousness, and you can make an easy transition to kind of go up towards the New York elitist snob direction or down towards the redneck edition of this, and you're going to enjoy like a delicious kind of dinner either way. I definitely grew up on powdered Hidden Valley Ranch experimental cooking. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
See, I didn't know that existed either.
I am from the Midwest, and we do love our ranch dressing. That is not just a cliche. That is the truth.
Wow. Powdered ranch dressing. I like the idea of kind of those, you know, subbing out the packaged ingredients and like leveling up.
Yeah, you can go in. And I think like the real thing is like either way, it's going to be delicious. And people have been going bananas for this dish. It's a super easy recipe. Definitely something worth giving a shot over the Super Bowl weekend or any time in this month, you know, check it out.
And Sam Sifton was just so great and likable and funny. Nice to kind of hear his voice. It's always nice to hear a writer's voice, you know, it's a little bit different. He was great. So check out that episode of Sharp and Hot, hear the full interview. And speaking of kind of writing, Jen Liuzzi had what I thought was a really provocative episode of Tech Bites this week, episode 49. As we mentioned earlier, Melissa Clark was on the show, and so was Lori Wooliver. I hope I'm doing that last name justice, who is not only a freelance writer and editor, but she's kind of Anthony Bourdain's gatekeeper. And it was a really great conversation on print versus digital and sort of the overall landscape for writing in food these days. And Lori had some great thoughts that I'm going to share right now.
And I will say that I still do not support myself as a writer solely. I mean, I have a whole other job, a part-time job. I work for Anthony Bourdain. I manage his schedule and do kind of an administrative role that's that helps me pay my mortgage and, you know, live in New York. I did the only two times I was able that I really was supporting myself as a writer was when I had two consecutive staff positions on magazines. And that was great in its own way. Mm. But it's very difficult. I mean, I've always kind of there's part of me that also kind of wants to have something else going on because the pressure of having to completely support yourself through writing and creative endeavors is very in New York is very. To me, too much. You know, the idea that I want to be able to have some hard skills that pay the bills that are not about me sitting down and writing something.
That is literally, I think, the best advice that you can give to somebody who wants to be a food writer is have some hard skills or become an expert in some kind of facet of the food industry. There's just not that many spots for people who want to just kind of blandly write about food. I have to give a shout out to this Billfold piece that Lori wrote back in June of 2014. The title is From Botanic Gardens Intern to Anthony Bourdain's Assistant. It's an amazing piece, which really fills out a lot of Lori's background. She basically takes you through graduating college to now and the like dirty nitty gritty of being a wannabe food writer, food worker on the come up. It's hilarious. One of my favorite lines from the piece, right at the beginning, she's talking about, her first job as an intern at the Botanic Gardens here in New York City. And she's like, I packed my lunch every day, usually a damp, tragic hummus pita and an apple. And I just feel like, man, I ate that damp, tragic hummus pita so much when I was just out of college and trying to figure out like what was next for me. Great piece, really interesting woman. Definitely such a fun episode. I love that clip.
Also, skills that pay the bills. Great mantra. Gotta love that.
You know it.
So, last clip that we're gonna play is a very political clip, and I know a lot of my friends are kind of revved up in the political space with the primaries happening right now. I thought this week's town hall was on the Democratic side was really excellent. Actually, I don't know if you've been have you got the fever yet? The primary fever.
The primary fever. I have to say, probably one of the more interesting memes I saw out there on the internet this week was a breakdown of the candidates looking at how much each candidate had spent on pizza so far in the campaign.
Oh, yeah. Carly Fiorina, $0.
$0.
That's a problem.
$0. Come on, Carly. What is up? Hillary leading the pack with, I think, around $9,000 on pizza. Bernie kind of right in the middle, $3,000. And then, Ted Cruz, who won out in Iowa this week, was coming in at a respectable $2,481. I don't think that means pizza that the candidates themselves were eating, but, maybe their staff. I wonder what the pizza to electoral victory correlation is going to be, and I'm looking forward to continuing to cover this important issue and more.
Oh, yeah, and amount spent versus actual pizzas, What are we talking about here?
How fancy is that pizza?
So, shifting back to food in a real way, Katie Kiefer had Congressman Tim Ryan, who's a Democrat from Ohio, the U.S. representative for the 13th District, and they talked about a lot of really great food issues, as Katie always does on her show. This was episode 179, and I thought he made a really great point at the end of the show. So let's check out a little snippet of that.
At the end of the day, I know you don't want to get involved in politics, but this all comes down to what are the federal policies.
Yeah.
And you can't just say, I'm going to go to Whole Foods and hope things change. If you want to shift for your kids, for your grandkids, you have to shift the policies. You have to shift the subsidies. And though you may not like politics, you better get into the game or the status quo is going to continue to, rear its ugly head. And that means bad things for the environment, and that means bad things for the food system.
Man, I loved this episode. I think, too, he really brings up an interesting point. It reminds me of a conversation I had with an instructor of mine when I was in graduate school talking about, replacing all the light bulbs in your house with the long-lasting ones. He's like, that's great, but if your municipality has electric lines that are like grossly leaking energy, you can change all the light bulbs in the world and nothing's going to matter. And I think, the congressman is really getting across here a similar point that it's great, and it is important for individuals to be making changes on that like person-to-person level, but it's a big, it's a big lift. The federal government spends a lot of money on food. It spends a lot of money kind of directing the way food is grown in this country. And it's hard to kind of wrap your head around. And so I'm excited to see more and more that, you know, political candidates are feeling like this is an issue I have to be able to speak on and talk about in a variety of ways from, you know, not just looking at, the farm bill, but also looking at like farmland preservation and conservation and food safety. It's something that's really going to be, I think, more and more at the tip of candidates' tongue. So beyond looking at their pizza consumption, we look forward and invite you all to come and join us. Bernie, Hillary, Ted, Carly, come by Heritage Radio. Tell us what's on your agenda for food in 2016, 2017 and beyond.
Well put. And with that, we are going to move into the breakdown section of this show. All right. The moment.
This is the moment of truth. I am super excited to be joined this week by Kathy Irway. Kathy is a longtime host on the Heritage Radio Network. She hosts a weekly program called Eat Your Words, which covers the world of food as you see it in books, cookbooks, memoirs, texts, instructional manuals. Really, if it's written in print, Kathy has probably covered it at some point. She is also an acclaimed food writer in her own right. She's the author of two books, most recently The Food of Taiwan, a memoir, and a great collection, a great intro to the food of Taiwan and Taiwanese cooking. And then, of course, the ever famous and much loved The Art of Eating In, where Kathy basically chronicles, breaking the cycle of eating out, which is a big struggle here in New York. And we are super thrilled to have her join us on the Week in Review. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, how's it going, Erin?
It's
Thanks for the intro.
Oh, man. Well, I am stoked. So here's the thing. You know, you are a person who has, you know, the finger on the pulse of the cookbook world. And I feel like every other day there's like a million cookbooks kind of hitting the like stream, whether it's, you know, in bookstores or coming in as like pitches and PR requests. And I guess I want to say, like, can you give us a little bit of overview of like what's the state of the cookbook nation right now? How do we start to kind of compartmentalize all of these books? Like, what's going on lately?
Well, I think in the last year or so, I've seen a number of trends. So, I mean, first and foremost, food books, cookbooks are not going away anytime soon. It seems to be a growing, ever-expanding topic. However, I think in the last year or so, we have finally seen a cool down of really popular restaurant-focused cookbooks and also small artisanal food business-focused cookbooks. So, you know, the Jammers, the Bakers, and the trendy restaurateurs, we've seen their books come out and So in place of that, though, I'm really excited about this trend that I'm seeing recently, which is taking a niche food topic and really exploring it from nuts to bolts. So, for instance, I had a book called Paw Paw on the show, and I have another book on my shelf called Cheddar. And these are taking a real deep dive into these food topics, whatever the niche is, cheddar, paw paw, whatever. And exploring it not just in a culinary sense, but for its history and cultural relevance. So that's really exciting to me. Another thing I've seen kind of slowing down is more sort of general interest books around green, local, sustainable food and sort of like exposés and, you know, calls to arms around this. And I think that's a good sign. Because I think it seems to say that we get it now, and we understand that as a culture that, you know, hey, there's problems in our food policy and our food system, so let's step away from the really general explorations of that. A good example, I think, of the more general one is Lita Meredith's The Locavore Handbook. So it's a really practical kind of one-stop, you know, place to figure out what's going on in the food world. So I think that that'll branch out into more specific food policy topics, and I'm looking forward to them. I hope more people pitch those books to me. And last but not least, actually, one more sort of like, just kind of like fringe trend. Actually, not so fringe anymore. I used to see like wild edibles and anything forage being talked about in a really fringe way and seldom talked about. But thanks to restaurateurs like Noma and so forth, I think that wild food topics are becoming more trendy. So I have a book coming out that explores that. And I think that's real progress because, you know, at first home cooks were a little scared about the idea of picking something in the park or backyard. So that's exciting.
Yeah, I can relate to that. You're like, I feel like mushrooms are like always the scary thing, but ultimately yeah. I'm like, well, if I pick the wrong dandelion leaf, I think it's just going to like taste really bad, but I'm not going to yeah. die.
And I get it, you know, restaurants may be leading that trend, but, you know, with this fantastic presentations of their, I don't know, nasturtium, I guess that's not that wild, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, so, I do.
Pine needles and what have you. So, but, you know, I hopefully that'll make people just look at food and look at the wilderness in a different way. So it's interesting. Last but not least, I think we're seeing a burgeoning topic or genre around foodie lits. I recently had Jessica Tom, whose novel Food Whore, was on the show. I know Ruth Rochelle has written a novel that has to do with food, and I think it's pretty new ground and just in its infancy. We've seen a lot of these, I'll call it foodie lit novels written by women, and you might otherwise call them sort of chick lit with a food focus. but actually one exception to that, that I was very pleased to be pitched to, about was a first time novelist, named Ryan Stredall in his acclaimed book called The Kitchens of the Great Midwest. And it is not at all chick lit. It's more serious fiction, and it just so happens to deal with food. So I think, yeah, I think I'm really excited to see what more happens in this growing genre.
So I can maybe hold out a dream of like a boudoir novel that is like food and romance focus.
Sex,
but I feel like there's some real dramatic reading opportunities. Well, I want to shift a little bit and kind of come back to an area of your expertise, really thinking about the home cook. When, you know, oftentimes I think, oh man, there's so many books, like how do I choose? How do I use them? If you were going to kind of like look to someone and say like, you know, this is your strategy, if you're only going to get like 3 books or 5 books, like, what are the books you would choose, or what are the types of books if we're just starting to build our collection, but we want to focus on actually cooking, not having kind of beautiful coffee table books. What are we on the lookout for? What do you recommend?
Great question. So this is my strategy, and maybe you feel differently, but I love to collect a really great authoritative cookbook about a certain cuisine. So example, Madhur Jaffery's Vegetarian India, great cookbook. Or maybe it's Marcel Hazan's The Essentials of Italian Cooking, super classic. Or Grace Young's stir-frying cookbook or Chinese cookbook. She has a few. And just sort of collect from there whichever cuisines you really like. You know, get Jacques Pepin's French cookbook for some basics. Because there's a lot of cookbooks out there, oftentimes by bloggers, nothing against that, but there's just sort of a smorgasbord of a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And you can, I don't know, I think that this is great for folks who are really casual about cooking and not going to do it that much. But if you really want to build a repertoire and kind of learn more, I think it's great to collect basically a chapter where you can experiment and get to know Japanese food next, or, you know, Peruvian food and so forth, and learn a little bit more about the culture, because those books are going to tell you that, and you'll get more insight into that one culture and cuisine, I should say, rather than a book that is sort of like a coffee table collection of enticing, pretty foods.
Yeah. Well, but you can have both. I'm not saying you can't have both. I was just curious. Well, kind of final question. You know, Valentine's Day is coming up. I think you have a pretty exciting guest on the books for that week. And then also just wondering any like V-Day home cooking tips for the folks out there.
I think that it depends where you are in your love life, but it doesn't hurt to make something. And even if it's for your friends, you know, make some truffles. I mean, that's really fun. And it's a project, sure. But I just think it's really great to make something delicious and sweet to show and give somebody and hopefully share it together. So I guess that's my kind of lowball answer.
I like it. Delicious, yeah, sweet truffles to share. I mean, I'm into it. I hope that I make the cut if you are doing some
cooking. Bring it to your
coworkers cooking
the next day, you know?
Like, bring it to the radio station.
Sure.
We like snacks. Awesome. Well, Kathy, thank you so much again. That show, for you guys who have not had the opportunity to check it out yet, is Eat Your Words. Great selection of cookbooks. Definitely search out the archive. You can hear more from some of those authors that Kathy mentioned and explore maybe building your own cookbook collection. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Erin.
All right. Awesome. I have to jump in and just say that I got to go to Kitchen Witch when I was in New Orleans, which is apparently like next to Bonnie Slotnick, one of the biggest cookbook collection stores in the country. And my mind was totally blown going through some of those books Kathy mentioned, too. It's like, definitely if you're in New Orleans, hop on over there.
Yeah. Support local bookstores wherever you are.
That's right. All right. Let's give some big ups, shall we? This, of course, being the part of the show where we big up people, places, things that we're loving right now. The theme song courtesy of the band Big Ups, former engineers here at Heritage Radio Network. So, Erin, I'll let you kick it off. Who you want to big up this week?
Well, I have Valentine's Day on the brain, and only because I actually have two sisters who are not twins who both have their birthday on Valentine's Day. So for me, it's always been like less of a romance holiday and more of like a family celebration holiday. And this year is no different because my mom's is coming to town. So I have to give a soft big up to my mom's, of course. But I want to give my like official week in review big up to the folks over at Humboldt and Jackson, Pam and Bill. Great little restaurant bar in Williamsburg. It's at 434 Humboldt, and they are going to be celebrating the Valentine's week with our friends here at Roberta's, doing the square pizza pie pop-up from February 8th through the 14th. And if you are a square pizza pie lover, you guys gotta get out. You have to check out Humboldt and Jackson, hang, get a couple slices. That's where I'm going to be spending my Valentine's Day with my moms and some friends, eating delicious pizza. And really a big fan of what they're doing at Humboldt and Jackson. It's a great space. They've got all different kinds of events going on. Pam was a co-host of one of our ladies nights here with the Heritage Radio Network, and just want to throw them some love and say that, like, guys, please reserve like two really big pizzas for me because I didn't get enough last time you did the pop-up. So I'm like, I'm on it. I'm reserving it. I'm like going to be eating a lot of pizza, and I cannot wait.
Well, you stole my first idea. I was definitely going to big up moms as well. That's just always like my
Mom's
Valentine's
week.
Day move for sure. We can do it next week. Valentine's Day is still a little bit of ways away. But big ups to MoFad, who had another event yesterday, I believe, called PH Delicious with Johnny Hunter, who is like the Madison food magician, if you will. I know you had breakfast with Johnny the other day, Erin, and he's definitely a friend of the network, the Underground Food Collective. They do incredible things out there, and he was in town doing a demo with Dave at MoFad.
They were looking at pH, like how your kind of like acid and bases impact food.
Exactly. So it looks like it was a hit. I just saw some photos this morning. So congratulations to that team. They continue to do really provocative stuff in that space, and it's just really incredible to watch them grow. So big ups, MoFad.
Woo woo.
And that about does it for us this week on The Week in Review.
It happened so fast.
I know, right?
It was so fun.
I hope you learned something. I hope you laughed. If you didn't, please write us and complain. you know, we'll send you like a pizza coupon or something. But tweet us, heritage_radio, email info@heritageradionetwork.org. We would love to know what you're liking and not liking, want to hear more of, want to hear less of. And we will continue to be here every week on Friday for you so that your podcast game is all set up for the weekend and you can catch up on the week's news here and head into the next week strong. So we'll see you next week. I'm Jack Inslee.
And Aaron Fairbanks. See you later.
Peace.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.